Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. Nice to have you with us today. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live, but not the video streaming today, from our studios in New York City. This is the program each week, no guest. It's called Talk Back, where people have a chance to share their points of view. Now, I'm not sure we'll be able to get people in because we're having difficulty on one of our lines. But if that's the case, no problem. We have a lot to share. I'm going to give you what to do if you have depression, what can help lower your rates of tooth decay, which is a big issue. We're eating what? The drugstore in U.S. Meat by Martha Rosenberg. Also today, from our environmental segment, an American Fukushima is possible. Also, will President Obama restore the rule of law during his second term? We're going to quote from him. I think you'll find that interesting. And we have to take a look at why there are so many fetal deaths reported when women take the flu vaccine. How much more? There's an increase of 4,250%. You heard me right. 4,250% increase in fetal deaths to the federal government's own reporting agency when pregnant women got the flu shot. And yet, the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service, doesn't seem to matter because they're not doing a thing about it. We will. We have a lot to share. Let us begin. We have tens of millions of Americans, understandably so, who are suffering from various forms of depression. I grew up, as many of you did, I'm sure, where we had blue moods and knew people who were in kind of an off mood, but there was really no one diagnosed when I grew up with clinical depression. In fact, I remember once, and this was one of those moments in life I never forgot, where there was a woman who was widowed, who lived at the end of our little street. And what made her so special to me was she'd been a school teacher her whole life. She was, and school teachers where I grew up didn't have to retire. They could teach forever. In fact, I had a school teacher that taught my father, my older brother, and myself. And she was teaching for over 40 years. In any case, this woman, her name was Hattie. She had a backyard that was just so beautiful. Now, for a young creative guy like me, who loved colors, and seeing all these different colors in her backyard, and butterflies, and she had a little beehive, everything was just perfect back there. And I would sit back on a swing, and she'd give a cup of tea, herbal tea, from her garden, and even the honey came from her garden. And I was always honest. I didn't feel that there were any questions that were inappropriate just to ask. And one day I'm sitting there on the swing, and I asked her, I said, "Are you afraid of dying?" And she looked at me and she said, "Why would you ask that?" I said, "Well, because when I look at people, no one ever talks about death. They just kind of accept it. And as you're older, and do you ever think about it?" And she says, "Of course." She says, "Everybody thinks about dying once they pass a certain age." And she was referring at that point to 30. Because by the time you were 40, you were well beyond middle age when I was growing up. And that's because there was such a radical difference in how people looked and felt and acted between 20, 40, and 60. I mean, it was just really bad. When you consider looking at Alfred Hitchcock on his 60th birthday, he looked 90. And yet we had people in our own culture, the signers of Declaration of Independence, like Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, lived very long lives and were very healthy for a long into that extended lifespan. And then the life expectancy at the beginning of the 19th century was only about 29. So where I grew up, everyone had a view, I mean everyone, that once you pass a certain age, you simply enjoy the life you have in front of you. And I wondered, gee whiz, does that make you sad? And so I asked her, do you feel sad? She says, well, there are times when I feel sadness of what I no longer have in my life. My husband and all the wonderful memories that he and I shared together, that's gone. Some of my friends have passed, that's gone. I remember the best of those moments, and that's why I keep their pictures on my mantles around the house. She said, just sitting here in this backyard, as I do year after year, waiting for spring and waiting for the blossoms and waiting for summer and waiting for the wonderful aromas that come out, waiting for the garden when I can harvest. She says, I understand that in the near future I won't be here. So someone else will have the advantage of this. Hopefully they'll keep it, but who knows? And she says, so, you know, you're so young, Gary, and you're asking questions that no one ever asks, but you've always been very curious about everything in life, so you ask these questions. And what stuck in my mind was that I'm sure we had a lot of depression. We just didn't call it depression because it was just life, especially when you knew that you couldn't control always the outcome. And so when we look at what we cannot control, it's far more than what we can control. You know, we can't control whether people be kind to us or not, or whether they'll honor us or dishonor us. And could you imagine being General Petraeus' wife of 37 years and then wake up to the fact that, you know, for whatever reason, I don't want to assume I know his motives, chose to betray her. Imagine how you would feel when you could not control the attention and what you thought, assumed, was an unchallengeable, exclusive relationship. In any case, we're depressed. A lot of people are, at varying degrees. The difference is I don't believe that it is a brain chemical imbalance. That does not mean that our body and what we eat and breathe and drink won't impact our moods. Certainly will. But the fact that we are given this absolute, that bipolar is real, children have it because they laugh and cry, because you might be happy or sad, that's normal behavior. So if you simply want to be as healthy as you can, and if you are suffering from some depression, according to the Canadian Journal of Psychiatry, taking the omega-3 fatty acids could certainly help you battle some of that depression. And if you're in postpartum depression, definitely will help, because your hormones are all upset after a pregnancy. And not all women regain the balance of their hormones real quick. So as a result, those that have that imbalance may suffer from that. Now, vitamin D is very important. And the newest study shows that it's linked with the lower the vitamin D in your body, the more diabetes. The higher the vitamin D, the lower diabetes. When you consider how many tens of millions of Americans have either diabetes or prediabetes, then you take a look at this latest study and think, wow, something that simple, vitamin D, could make a difference. Researchers at the University of California, San Diego, performed a 6-year analysis of 2,000 people, and what they found was the higher the levels of vitamin D3, the lower the incidence of diabetes. Quote, previous studies proposed the existence of an association between vitamin D deficiency and risk of type 1 diabetes, but this is the first time that the theory has been tested in a way that provides a dose-response relationship. So that's good information. Next up, vitamin D also lowers the rate of tooth decay. Who would have ever thought that? But according to Science Daily, in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition Review, when they took a look at a control trials, 24 of them, 24 separate trials, spanning a long period of time, over 60 years, they found that the higher the vitamin D level, the lower the risk of tooth decay. Well, that's good. So now all we have to do is make sure we're getting between 1,000 to 3,000 units a day of vitamin D3, and we can lower the risk not only of diabetes, but also tooth decay. And for having healthier, hydrated skin, mushroom extracts for even toned. This is from Dana Norick of Natural News. She says, mushrooms are an often overlooked source of skin-loving nutrition because of their status as a member of the nightshade family, which gives some a negative association with the fungus. While it's true that some mushrooms can contain trace organic toxins and should be moderately consumed, there are also some compelling medicinal benefits for the skin that must be considered. Topical use of mushroom extracts yield impressive results on the skin. And several types of mushrooms are used in topical creams and serums and facial preparations for anti-aging ingredients. And the extracts are often cited as potent antioxidants and natural moisturizers, which can also help to naturally brighten the skin and lighten age spots and even out the tone. And topical applications of mushrooms, such as maitake, shiitake, tremella, and others are used extensively for this, and it talks about how they help with the hydration, the plumping out of the skin, and they also have what is called kojic acid, which acts as a natural skin lightener, and it's also anti-inflammatory and therefore helps you if you've had eczema or psoriasis or acne, etc. I'm sure that crossing the television dials, on occasion you've come to or even sought out one of those cooking shows. I don't like any of them. Now, I haven't seen all of them, but the ones I've liked are absolutely at the bottom of my list. Here's why. Man versus food. If people take that to heart, then there's a high probability that they end up with a heart attack or stroke, diabetes, or obesity. They also could end up with ruptured intestines because you're putting an enormous amount of food far beyond what a body can consume in a healthy way. You're putting that into your body. 5 pounds, 6 pounds of food at one sitting, and almost always this is the worst possible processed foods. Pork and beefs and deep fried and sugars and carbohydrate, always refined. There's nothing healthy in any of that. And then other people cheer them on, and then you look at those people, and they're also generally unhealthy and overweight. That's one type. Eating exotic parts of animals, that's another type. And then there's all these competitive iron chefs. Well, first of all, none of them would I like because they're just not likable. They have terrible personalities. Everything is competitive. Everything is beat everyone else to get some superficial, supercilious, completely meaningless title of being the best at something, which means nothing. You're only the supposed best of a small group of people you're competing with, not all the great chefs. In fact, probably the greatest chef living in America is David Boulay. Now, you may not know of David Boulay unless you're a connoisseur of great food, but David Boulay has the highest rating from the echelon on quality of his cooking. He's a real teacher. He teaches. I just finished filming, so it sticks right in my mind about the patience and time and energy he takes to make ordinary food extraordinary and how they look and taste. And I ask him, why in all your 40 years have you not done any films? And he said, because it's a limited medium for him. He said, look, it sometimes takes 2 hours just to discuss and to show how to make a vegetable broth that's right, that is what you need. He said, television wants everything real fast, and they want it highly competitive. And he's a very, you know, very low-key guy. That's not his medium. So frequently when we see the spike blonde guy out there eating all the garbage and, you know, roar, 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 it's great. No, it's not. You know, you're not looking at the next day when that person's sitting for 14 hours on a toilet trying to get it vacated out of their body. You're not looking at the hemorrhoids someone's got. You're not looking at the bleeding in their intestine. You're not looking at the blood sugar in a fasting level going up to 200, all because they thought this was a good idea. So adding to all this is a comment from Op-Ed News from Martha Rosenberg. Let me quote it. It says, "We're eating what? The drugstore, and the U.S. meat. Food consumers seldom hear about the drugs, estradiol 17, Zearalol, Trenbolone acetate, and another form of gestrol acetate, that are never on a meat label. But those synthetic growth hormones are central to U.S. meat production, especially beef, and is the reason Europe has banned a lot of the U.S. meat since 1989. Zearalanol, widely used as a growth promoter in the U.S. beef industry, is known for its, quote, ability to stimulate growth and proliferation of human breast tumor cells. Known carcinogen diethylstilbestrol, end quote, says the Breast Cancer Fund. And Zearalanol may, quote, play a critical role in mammary tumorigenesis and be a risk factor for breast cancer, end quote. And that's from the College of Food and Science and Nutrition Engineering at China Agricultural University in Beijing. But why, then, is such a drug that requires, quote, appropriate personal protection equipment for use, quote, laboratory coat, gloves, safety glasses, and mask, routinely used in our U.S. meat production and not even labeled? You have the acetate, the melanogestrel acetate, which is a synthetic progestin put in feed. It's 3,000% as active as natural progesterone. That's according to the European Commission. And trenbolone acetate, a synthetic androgen, is several times more active than testosterone. And it's administered as ear implants, commonly seen as livestock operations. And operators say the implants and the ears are removed from the human food supply at the slaughterhouse. Well, I'm aware that almost every part of an animal that is not consumed by humans is consumed by other animals. So that goes in our dog and cat food. Why did the European Commission ban meat made with such chemicals? Quote, there's an association between steroid hormones and certain cancers and an indication that meat consumption is possibly associated with increased risk of breast cancer and prostate cancer. That's according to the European Commission's Committee on Veterinary Measures. Quote, the highest rates of breast cancer are observed in North America, where hormone-treated meat consumption is highest in the world. End quote. In fact, a scientist out of Korea has only 7 new cases of breast cancer per year per 100,000 people. That's according to the European Commission report. Whereas non-Hispanic Caucasians in Los Angeles have 103 new cases of breast cancer per 100,000 people. So the breast cancer rate also increases among immigrant groups when they move to the United States. And that means it's not genetic, it's environmental. And any growth drug used in the United States, beef, pork, or turkey, yes, turkey, is dangerous. One of them is called ractopamine, and it's an asthma-like drug called a beta drug. And like other hormones, it lets livestock operators produce more weight more quickly from their animals. And it's also integrated into the food supply under the Reporters and Consumers radar more than 10 years ago. It became a favorite of U.S. farm owners when it was shown that it could increase muscle by repartitioning nutrients and slowing protein degradation. And unlike other veterinary drugs used in the U.S., meat that are withdrawn before slaughter or thrown away as ears, this drug is begun in the days before slaughter and never withdrawn. It's given to cattle for the last 20 to 42 days, to pigs for their last 28 days, and to turkeys for their last 7 to 14 days. And yet we're supposed to say, why should we be concerned? I'm very concerned, so just keep in mind, when you eat your hamburger or your hot dog, when you eat your salami on the pizza, when you eat your bologna, when you eat the turkey sandwiches, do you have any idea how many different medications, how many really toxic cancer-causing drugs are used? Because all those are going into your body. Good news for those of you who periodically fast, and I'm sure many people in this audience do. And it's always good one day a week to do just juices. Now, you can have your protein shake in the morning and the afternoon, and you can put your coconut oil and flaxseed oil in there, and your black cumin seed oil. You can have all those great fatty acids. You can throw in some walnuts. let it all puree in, and drink that down, then just have juices throughout the day. This is one more reason that you should fast periodically. This is from the Health Impact News. Quote, study finds intermittent fasting reduces heart disease. The ability, quote, of intermittent fasting, meaning caloric restriction, to modulate a biochemical reaction in the body is protective against coronary heart disease. And they did this study and found that it worked. So, quote, these findings suggest that this periodic fasting with liquid diet favorably modulates visceral fat and adipokines in a way that may confer protection against coronary heart disease. So that's something that a lot of people have known for a long time, but I'm glad to see they just did a study to confirm it. And we're going to take a break and come back. I'm going to give you a more in-depth analysis of why you should think twice before having completely healthy breasts removed because you had the so-called gene, all right, and also 20 herbs from native populations around the world for remedying acidity. And they have a good way of doing it, so we're going to share that with you. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart, and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane with a happy refrain. Just singing, singing in the rain.
Nice to be with us today, everyone. I was told that we can't take calls because we're having a changeover of some of our computer systems. And so we'll take him on tomorrow's show. And I'm going to share information from Green Med Info from Sayre G. And about what is called breast removal as a form of prevention. First, Alan Rose, Miss America contestant, announced in early November of this year that she would be undergoing a double mastectomy to prevent breast cancer. Rose, a healthy 24-year-old Maryland native who lost her mother to breast cancer when she was 16, has been lauded by certain media outlets as an awareness-raising role model for having the courage to take this precautionary step and for spreading her mastectomy-inspired message of preventative health care to the masses. Now, many of the reports discussed how her decision was spurred by her awareness of having a genetic predisposition to breast cancer. Then, on November 22nd, the New England Journal of Medicine published a review of the past 30 years of mammography, finding that not only has the widespread promotion and adaptation of breast screenings by millions of women not, I repeat, not reduced their death, on to the contrary, screenings have increased the relative risk of death, but that 1.3 million of these women were overdiagnosed and wrongly treated for abnormal findings that were not even cancer, meaning they were screening detected breast anomalies or abnormalities that if left untreated would have caused no harm to the women. Well, not surprisingly, this paradigm-challenging finding and the tradition of embargoed science was exactly timed to be released to the public on the eve of the major holiday. Subsequently, while folks unplug from electronic media for a rare family day centered around Thanksgiving dinner, the already watered-down headlines received only lackluster attention, considering the true gravity of this study's findings. how many who did happen to scan headlines released on that day, such as, quote, study false breast exams, truly grasp that 70,000 women a year have their breasts either removed or disfigured, irradiated, and then are treated with chemotherapy and hormone suppressive therapies for cancer that are not there. They don't exist in those particular women. Now, Rose, of course, is not aware of the disturbing implications within the New England Journal of Medicine study, namely, that the women in her family that she believes all died from inherited breast cancer may actually have died not from breast cancer or breast cancer-associated gene mutations, but from the breast cancer treatments themselves, that is to say, as a result of overdiagnosis and subsequent psychological trauma and physical mistreatment by a completely out-of-touch medical system relying on intrinsically the carcinogenic diagnostic and treatment technologies to cut, burn, and poison our lesions that would never have progressed to cancer and may have simply regressed had they been left undetected and undisturbed. Nor is she aware that the so-called breast cancer genes, the BRCA1 and the BRCA2, are relevant because they interfere with DNA repair mechanisms related to radiation and chemotherapy exposure, implying that avoiding unnecessary radiation exposure, such as x-rays, mammogram, and chemicals such as have been found in many pink-washed consumer products like a Kentucky Fried Chicken, the acrylamides, or some of the yogurts, is of the utmost importance in reducing her risk of breast cancer. Truth be told, even the widely attributed increased breast cancer death associated with BRCA1 and 2, and by the way, there are actually several thousand variations in these genes within the human population, may be a myth. A British Medical Society cancer article found that although the BRCA-positive patients have more frequently negative prognostic factors, their prognosis, the actual risk of breast cancer associated with death, appears to be equal or better in patients with BRCA-WT, the typical non-mutagen form found in the majority of the population. Other studies have emerged demonstrating that BRCA's supposed reaper-like hold on women's health is a myth. This is not an academic issue, since mastectomy rates have actually been increasing since 2004, no doubt due to the heightened anxiety over and the vast oversimplification of the BRCA gene-related risks. So in Rose's mind, as in the minds of millions of women who participate in the annual breast cancer awareness, pink washing campaigns, there is no known cause to cancer outside of your own genes, i.e. hundreds of thousands of novel carcinogens modern human beings have created don't exist. Because this has been the quarter of a century-long focus of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And since there is no known cure either, raising money for future research and promoting mammography at each and every step, and now removing healthy breasts before a problem occurs is all you can do within that model. But Rose's story took an even stranger twist when her genetic test revealed that she was, in fact, negative for the breast cancer susceptibility genes, BRCA1 and 2, the would-be genetic inevitability of cancer implied by her positive family history of the disease and her disturbing choice to have her breasts removed in order to prevent disease within them, was therefore strictly theoretical, unsubstantiated by empirical evidence. And yet, despite these negative findings, she stated that she still plans to have them removed sometime after the upcoming Miss America contest. So it turns out that Rose's risk of breast cancer may indeed have been inherited through her family in the form of irrational fears passed down. So here we have it, a completely healthy woman with completely healthy breasts and no gene susceptibility who's going to have her breasts removed. I mean, what is the purpose of that? To me, that makes no sense whatsoever. And I believe that only by exposing this entire fraud of the war on cancer can we really understand the truth of any of this. Mind you, you could have an abnormal breast finding, such as ductal carcinoma in situ, and which is the primary form of cancer detected through mammography, and that does not imply an irrepressible trajectory towards death. To the contrary, the latest New England Journal of Medicine finding indicates that the vast majority of such abnormalities would never progress to cause harm to women. To the contrary, by treating such conditions, if they are cancer, the treatment itself drives those tissues into greater malignancy, and through the profound psychological and physiological abuse over-treatment produces, creates the ideal conditions for cancers to proliferate and reoccur. I have done a lot on this subject, but I intend to do more because it's just not getting out there. Now, let's say that you have acidity. Most people do. Why? Because most of our diet is highly acidic. Sugars, alcohol, meat, sandwiches, those are highly acid, whereas fruits and vegetables, more often than not, nicely alkaline. Well, the traditional storage of ethnobotanical knowledge and memory and practice has a long history, according to Dr. Deepak Acharya, and he wants us to know that there's a lot we can do that other cultures have done around the world for relieving acidity. I would agree with that. For example, one of the things you can use is asparagus. Asparagus root powder is one of the remedies they use. Also, I would use the Bararia, B-A-R-L-E-R-I-A. That is the juice of the leaves, and that's been used for a long time. Acordia, that's important. Also, I'm not going to give all of them because you won't be able to find them all, but some like their the Cleptia, that's a powder made from the whole plant, and it's a fruit, and it is very beneficial. So those are ones that can make a difference and help you stop from being so acidic. And finally, there's a doctors now charging for extra visits when patients ask questions. Listen to this from J.D. Hines of Natural News. Are you uncertain about your medical condition? Have a few questions for your doctor? Well, if so, you might want to bring extra money with you the next time you go for a visit. Or better yet, ask your doctor's receptionist before you go in, will I be charged for asking questions? Like airlines that charge for extra luggage and banks that charge you to let you use your own money, now doctors and clinics are charging for something they have implored patients to do for decades, ask questions about treatment, diagnosis, and anything else they don't understand. What's next, a second opinion surcharge? So baffling is the practice that even seasoned, experienced medical professionals don't get it. Just ask Susan Krantz, a Minnesota registered nurse with a business background, who noticed a strange charge recently on a doctor's office bill. She says, even as a registered nurse, I can't figure out what this is. And you can be charged if you ask too many questions. She was upset when she opened her bill and found, along with a list of procedures performed, an itemized charge of $50 for something she didn't get. She called her clinic to inquire and was puzzled by the response. Quote, you can be charged an extra office visit if you ask too many questions, she said. Well, medical coding and billing is as precise as it is complex, most often requiring specially trained personnel to enter charges, lest the physician's practice be audited and fined by state and federal watchdog agencies. So, ask your doctor questions, and you can end up with a large bill. And one other thing, bee pollen, one of the world's most perfect superfoods, and I want to close off our health nutrition segment with this, because one of the most wondrous of all substances on the planet is bee pollen, and it does not get any attention. Now, when I started into health, it was common to have royal jelly and bee pollen and raw honey together as part of an elixir, a health drink, each day. But bee pollen has a lot of special nutrients. It's a phenomena. Pollen is the tiny male seed required for fertilization that exists in blossoms of flowers. So when bees go into the flower and collect the nectar from the flowers, these tiny yellow, tan, orange, or brown balls of pollen stick to their legs, thus creating bee pollen. And bee pollen is a special substance that can only be produced by nature. Man-made pollen does not possess the same unique properties, even though it is chemically identical. And as far as science can determine, you know, they should be the same, but they're not. When laboratory synthesized pollen is fed to bees, they die, even though all the known nutrients are present. Even with the latest technology, science cannot identify some of the special components that exist in bee pollen. A study published in the Journal of National Cancer Institute demonstrated that effects of bee pollen on mice were specifically bred to develop and die of cancerous tumors. The mice in the control group developed tumors, as expected, at an average rate, age of 31 weeks. The bee pollen-fed group, mind you, they were only fed one part bee pollen to 10,000 parts of food, had a delayed onset of tumors by 10 weeks, which was statistically significant. In addition, 7 mice from the bee pollen group still showed no signs of tumors at 62 weeks when the test was terminated. Also can improve physical performance. Bee pollen is used by many bodybuilders and Olympic athletes alike to increase strength and endurance. And the British Sports Council showed gains in strength by as much as 50% in people consuming bee pollen daily. Also, bee pollen is effective in combating, along with other nutritional approaches, diabetes, arthritis, and depression, and it has a very strong antibacterial effect, and can help also lower cholesterol and triglycerides. And it's very good in amino acid concentrations. So one more thing to consider that's on your side when it comes to health. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. We have a lot to cover. Sorry we can't take your calls today because our phone system's being improved. Back in a moment.
The cowboys, the wrestlers, the tumblers, the clowns, the roustabouts that move the show at dawn. The music, the spotlights, the people, the towns, your baggage with the labels pasted on.
The sawdust and the horses and the smell. The towel you've taken from the last hotel.
There's no business like show business like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing.
Everything the traffic will allow. No more could you have that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow.
There's no people like show.
Have you back, everyone? I'm Gary Noll. If you should miss a program, by all means, go to our archives and download any of the shows from the 13 hours of live broadcasting I do every week. The most popular shows are on the Progressive Commentary Hour or Conversations with Remarkable Minds, and they're there commercial-free for you. From our issues area, from William Boardman, from Opted News, an American Fukushima possible? Whistleblower says Nuclear Regulatory Commission broke law by suppressing staff reports that points to danger of as many as 34 American Fukushimas. The likelihood was very low that an earthquake followed by a tsunami would destroy all 4 nuclear reactors at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, but on March such and such 2011, that's what happened, and the accident has yet to be contained. Similarly, the likelihood may be low that an upstream dam will fail, unleashing a flood that will turn any of the 34 vulnerable nuclear plants into an American Fukushima. But knowing that unlikely events sometimes happen, nevertheless, the nuclear industry continues to answer the question of how safe is it? Are these going to go down anytime soon? They always say no. the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has known at least since 1996 that flooding danger from upstream dam failure was a more serious threat than the agency would publicly admit. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission failed from 1996 to 2011 to assess the threat even internally. In July 2011, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission staff completed a report, quote, "The external flooding due to upstream dam failure poses a larger than expected risk to plants and public safety," end quote. But the NRC did not make the 41-page report public. Instead, the agency made much of another report, quote, "recommendations for enhanced reactor safety," but didn't mention any of this. This was censored, and as a result, we were never told that this flooding could happen. Now, my thoughts on this. Helping with the anti-nuclear movement, as we have, and doing the documentary, two documentaries, actually, on nuclear power, the second one being Knocking on the Devil's Door, Deadly Nuclear Legacy, and the first one being Fatal Fallout. There is no such thing as a safe nuclear power plant. They all emit radiation every day. They're causing global warming because about 2 billion gallons of water per day must be drawn out of a lake or a river or the ocean, brought into the spent fuel rods in the core to cool them down, and then it goes back out again as very hot and radioactive water. That kills billions upon billions of fish per reactor. Now, at Indian Point, just shortly, let's say maybe 38 miles north of New York City, you have two plants. That's 4 billion gallons of water a day. Also, cancer hotspots, women who had breast cancer without having any risk factors. It was always when they lived close to a nuclear power plant. When the plant closed, was decommissioned, or they moved away, the cancer rate dropped substantially. And they're very expensive. And in the mining of the fuel to get these plants going, it all causes greenhouse gases. So they're not safe, and we should make it a national priority to close them all down. That's our environmental issue. Now, for a challenge to the President of the United States, this comes from Stephen Rohde from Truthout. I thought this was very interesting because he did some really good research here, and to quote the President himself, here's what he says. It's short but interesting. As President Barack Obama approaches the daunting challenges in his second term, confronting such complex issues as the fiscal cliff, unemployment, immigration, foreign wars, it is imperative that he also devote the authority and the resources of administration to restoring the rule of law. The American ideal of the rule of law took a beating under President Bush, and 4 years ago, candidate Obama campaigned to change all that. Quote, "These last few years, we've seen an unacceptable abuse of power at home. We've paid a heavy price for having a president whose priority is expanding his own power," end quote. And that was in Chicago in October 2007. That was Barack Obama. Yet, last May, the New York Times assessed the president's record on national security and concluded, quote, "Nothing else in Mr. Obama's first term has baffled liberal supporters and confounded conservative critics alike as his aggressive counterterrorism record," end quote. That's according to Georgetown University Law Professor David Cole. Obama has radically escalated drone strikes, continued military detention without charge, and military commissions for trying terrorists, prosecuted more government officials for leaks than all other presidents combined, maintained the discretion to render suspects to third countries, and opposed efforts to hold U.S. officials accountable for authorizing torture of terror suspects. The contrast between Obama's campaign promises and his performance in office during his first term is stark. On December 20th, 2007, the Boston Globe published the president-elect's responses to a questionnaire designed to elicit comparisons with the policies of the outgoing Bush administration. Ask if there were circumstances where the president as commander-in-chief is free disregard international human rights treaties that the U.S. Senate had ratified. And Obama responded that, quote, it is illegal and unwise for the president to disregard international human rights treaties that have been ratified by the United States Senate, including and especially the Geneva Conventions. The commander-in-chief's power does not allow the president to defy those treaties, end quote. But he has in every single case. As far as whether the president had inherent powers under the Constitution to conduct surveillance for national security purposes without judicial warrants, regardless of federal authorities, Obama responded to that the, quote, Supreme Court has never held that the president has such powers. As president, I will follow existing law. And when it comes to U.S. citizens and residents, I will only authorize surveillance for national security purposes consistent with FISA and other federal statutes, end quote. But he didn't. He broke the law again. Ask whether the Constitution permits, quote, a president to detain U.S. citizens without charges as unlawful enemy combatants. President Obama was unequivocal, quote, no, I reject the Bush administration's claim that the president has plenary authority under the Constitution to detain U.S. citizens without charges as unlawful enemy combatants, end quote. But he did it. Asked if, quote, Congress prohibits specific interrogation techniques, can the president instruct his subordinates to employ that technique despite the statute, Obama again was unequivocal. Quote, no, the president is not above the law and not entitled to use techniques that Congress has specifically banned as torture. We must send a message to the world that America is a nation of laws and a nation that stands against torture. As president, I will abide by statutory prohibitions for all U.S. government personnel and contractors. End quote. But he does. Every single thing he said, he turned and did the opposite. Quote, asked, if any executive power the Bush administration has claimed or exercised was unconstitutional, Obama declared, quote, I reject the view that the president may do whatever he deems necessary to protect national security and that he may torture people in defiance of congressional mandates, end quote. Well, significantly, he added, quote, detention of American citizens without access to counsel, fair procedure, or pursuit to judicial authorization as enemy combatants is unconstitutional. Yeah, but then you sign all these kill lists every week, and you have your black op people and 17 different agencies go out and abduct people, kill people, you do whatever you want. So man, oh man, boy, could words be used against a person. On New Year's Eve last year, Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which granted the government the power to put U.S. citizens in military detention indefinitely without the usual recourse to civil courts. In particular, the law authorized the detention of anyone, quote, who has substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. A lawsuit brought by someone who appears on the show regularly, Chris Hedges, and Daniel Ellsberg and Noam Chomsky argues that the law is so broad that it infringes on their First Amendment rights. Over strenuous arguments from the Obama Justice Department, U.S. District Judge Catherine Forrest, a recent Obama appointee, granted a preliminary injunction. She wrote that the government did not argue that the activities protected by the First Amendment could not subject an individual to indefinite military detention. Well, contrary to Obama's campaign pledges, his Justice Department strenuously defended the provision of the National Defense Authorization Act, allowing U.S. citizens to be indefinitely detained without traditional recourse to judicial review. And echoing precisely the arguments Bush lawyers made for years, Obama's lawyers told the court that the issue was one of its business, and that at most, courts would consider individual habeas corpus petitions after U.S. citizens have already been detained, but the court would have done none of it. Quote, that argument is without merit and indeed dangerous. If only habeas review is available to those detained under it, even U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, core constitutional rights available in criminal matters would simply be eliminated. No court can accept this proposition and adhere truthfully to its oath, end quote. So instead of accepting this wise and well considered judicial analysis. The Obama Justice Department fought on and succeeded in getting the injunction reversed. So despite its lofty promises to restore the rule of law, this president and his administration has vastly expanded the use of drones to kill U.S. citizens and civilians and alleged terrorists. In fact, on November 16th, Congressman Dennis Kucinich hosted a congressional briefing to examine the U.S. policy regarding the use of armed drones. And U.S. drone strikes are estimated to have killed thousands of people, including 3,378 in Pakistan, 1,952 in Yemen, 170 in Somalia, all sovereign countries with which the United States is not at war. So according to news reports, President Obama maintains a list of alleged militants to be assassinated. Some are U.S. citizens. None will get it to plead their case. The president tells us to trust that this is all perfectly legal and constitutional, even though Congress is not allowed to see any legal justification. According to Representative Kucinich, targeted killings of suspects is quite institutionalized as a permanent feature of the U.S. counterterrorism strategy, without any oversight, transparency, or accountability. Victims of drone strikes, including U.S. citizens, are secretly stripped of their right to due process and arbitrarily deprived of their life in violation of international human rights laws. So as the authors of a recent groundbreaking report by Stanford and New York universities on drones in Pakistan powerfully stated, quote, "In the United States, the dominant narrative about the use of drones in Pakistan is of a surgically precise and effective tool that makes U.S. safer by enabling targeted killing of terrorists with minimal downside of collateral impact. This narrative is false," end quote. So 4 years into the Obama administration's vast expansion of the program, members of Congress and the public are still being denied access to internal legal memos, which purportedly serve as the basis of the legal justifications for such killings. So this just lets you know that what you voted for and what you got are completely different. And then you have to ask yourself within, why are we refusing to hold him accountable for all of his contradictions and all the things that he's done? And that's for each of us to seek an answer to that for ourselves. And finally, to wrap up our program today, I'm concerned that there is fascism alive and well in the United States. I'm concerned that we have no rule of law. There are those laws that rule us, and then there are no laws, seemingly, that seem applicable to those who are the most powerful. If your company is producing a pharmaceutical drug like Vioxx, if you know in advance that it's dangerous, if you know all along that it can increase heart attacks and strokes, you intend to go ahead with it because, in your mind, the amount of money that you will make on the drug and even what you will pay in wrongful death suits or any penalties, it's just the cost of doing business. You will not be punished as an individual, as a corporate member, as the head of a company who made the decision to greenlight this. You are protected. Your charter protects you. Your lobbyists protect you. Your influence over congressional decisions protects you. You control the media. Your image will never be sullied or tarnished because of your acts. So when multinational corporations can engage in insider training, manipulation, lies, when they have been found guilty in thousands of lawsuits and yet their reputation is never tarnished, you and I, we break the law, our reputation goes down, and we're forgotten. So we don't have a rule by law. So I'm concerned they're now going to try to take away the last place that we have to share our thoughts and arguments and solutions, the Internet. This is the latest from J.D. Hayes, and it says the following. "Global government now seeks total control over the Internet." I'll quote this. "What is arguably the very last bastion of totally free speech is once again under assault by the world's tyrants, as the United Nations is now eyeing regulation of the Internet as though it was in need of being regulated." Why? It's an old story. Leaders of authoritarian regimes the world over hate the free flow of information that is disseminated via the Internet. They hate the fact that there's no way that they can maintain a monopoly on ideas and opinion within their own country with the Internet. They see notions of freedom and liberty as a threat. They despise any medium that undermines their grip on power. And their regimes are heavily represented in the UN, of which the United States, once considered the bastion of liberty and freedom, is the largest contributor. So that's why we have these problems. So just be aware there's a big effort underway to try to regulate the Internet. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. I look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day.
Everything that happens in life can happen in a show. You can make them laugh. You can make them cry. Anything, anything can go. A clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean, that's entertainment.